Welcome to this session of the Futures Forum. This year, all our sessions are asking, what sort of future are we creating for Australians in 2040? Our theme today is education and learning, and our guest, Professor Patrick Griffin, is, among other roles, the Director of the Assessment Research Centre at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. Professor Griffin is widely published on assessment and evaluation topics. His work has also had an important impact on developmental frameworks for teachers and school leaders in Australia. He was awarded the John Smythe Medal for Excellence in Research for his work on profiling literacy development. He's worked in various countries as well as Australia, including China and Vietnam, and was awarded in 2005 a UNESCO Research Medal by the Ministers of Education from Southern African nations. So he's been all over the world, and it seems very appropriate to ask, so Patrick, how will we learn in 2040?
Thanks, Charles. Just to do a little bit of advertising first. This book on predicted futures and curriculum change I wrote in 1985 while I worked in this building for the Ministry of Education. I took a quick look through it over the last couple of days, and it's uncannily accurate. These are much more recent versions of the 21st century type style work that I've been doing, and some of which I'm going to talk about tonight. Because I think some of the work captured in these books and in this one, which is also very current, it's the current textbook for Melbourne's pre-service course. Some of the work that we've done in that, I think, has really opened new ways of using technology particularly for assessment and prompting teaching and learning. And in the next few weeks, I'll start work with UNESCO in Geneva to start writing up the kind of competencies and work for at least a knowledge economy and maybe a networked economy. We'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. So this assessment and teaching of 21st century skills work started in 2009, and it's still going. And I had the privilege of leading that project in a sort of a global project, basically set up by Microsoft, Cisco and Intel, and then supporting that sort of work in digital workplaces. So a lot of what I say is influenced by that particular work, and a huge amount of momentum building to change education. And education is a very stubborn type of animal, very difficult and conservative, very difficult to change. And it really needs a very disruptive and a fairly shock therapy injection to get at least leaders of education thinking about change. Otherwise it just rolls on with a very small incremental change. One of the things that's likely to influence, and it's fascinating how little the conversation of the past 8 weeks has focused on this. You hear the word innovation and jobs, but we're talking about things that are disappearing. We're talking about the way in which we can see from this that the projection from using 1960 as a base, the kind of work of routine, manual, repetitive tasks are disappearing. Interpersonal service-type work is on the growth area. This is one that's set up in North America, but when the International Labour Organization did the same chart, the same pattern emerged. When we look at Australian contribution to gross domestic product of the various industries, we can see that manufacturing you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see what's happened to manufacturing industries in this country. But service industries are about the only thing that's on the incline. The implications for education are really quite serious, because we're still preparing students to work in factories. We're still preparing students in a manufacturing type economy and society. And our curriculum, our assessment, is still focused on how much people know, not how well they can think. And that's really the transition that's got to take place in education. We've got to stop force-feeding people with facts and information allowed Mr. Google to take that role and allow the teachers to be more about how well someone can think and how well they can make judgments about the relevance of information. This chart appeared about a year ago, set out by PricewaterhouseCoopers, saying that about 40%, or more than 40% of our jobs are going to disappear. Occupations are going to disappear within the next 10 to 15 years. That's 5 million occupations in Australia. That's why it really alarms me that we've been through this boring television episode of elections in Australia, and this has not been addressed at all. It seems to me that everybody's a little afraid to stick their neck out and make... But we can trace, I'll go back to this, we can trace this idea of where education has prepared kids for, in very gross terms. In an agrarian or agricultural society, they're prepared to go to the farm. In a manufacturing type economy, we prepare them to look at production and go to the factory. As we move into a knowledge economy, we need to move them from the farm to the factory to the office. And as we move into a networked or internet type society, a knowledge economy, we're going to move them to work on the internet. And when we think about the group of kids we've got in schools, we need to be thinking very clearly, very hard about what are we going to do with the kids that we used to prepare to go and do routine manual tasks. Because those kind of jobs can be routine, robots, mechanised, digitised, and once labour is removed from an occupation, it never goes back. So this project that I headed up for the last 5-6 years, called the Assessment and Teaching of 21st Century Skills, was really initiated by three giant digital companies, Cisco, Intel and Microsoft, who combined and formed what they called their social responsibility portfolio. And they held a post-conference workshop in San Diego in 2009. And they had 250 people come together to try and work out what they meant by, what was meant by the phrase 21st century skills. They charged the University of Melbourne with the responsibility of setting this up, but initially under the leadership of my colleague Barry McGaw, who came out of OECD and now heads up the Australian Curriculum and Assessment Advisory Board. Barry really conceptually set these manuals together and formulated the plans of how what would be meant by it. And we can see where the board was and just how this. We had vice presidents of Cisco, vice presidents of Intel, and the vice president of Microsoft. And they took it quite seriously at that level to take a global view. And they recruited ministers of education from these six countries into the project, and put up an advisory board with an advisory board was equally stellar, so it had quite a punch in terms of its persuasive power. When we think about the OECD, the International Education Association, Irona Bokova was the Director General of UNESCO at the time, the Director of the PISA project, the European Schools Neck, the National Academy of Sciences, the International Testing Commission, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank. These are not small organisations, and the punch that this particular project had was so serious that last year the PISA project, the Programme of International Student Assessment, tested in 53 countries the output of this project. So now, by the beginning of 2017, countries' ministers of education will be told where they rank in terms of students' capacity in collaborative problem solving, working as both social and cognitive skills development in the schools. So most of the force behind that was due to the fact that this was an incredibly high-powered executive board and advisory board that set this project up and which yielded these books. So the kind of occupations clearly are changing. This sort of work where we'd have factory where people would work in assembly lines is being altered. because the whole of a digital workplace has changed the way we think, it's changed the way we work, it's changed the way we learn, and it's changed the way we live. Normally, when I talk to people about this, there's more than one person with an iPad. It changed the way we attend meetings because we all take our computers with us, and if we haven't got an iPad, we've got an iPhone or we've got a smartphone, which, as we were saying just before we met, has got more computer power than one of the two original computers stored in the Melbourne Museum. So taking those together, the ways of thinking, creativity, critical thinking and decision making, metacognitive learning, communication, collaboration, all of those begin to be combined. And we met as a team in London, and I took over this project at the end of 2009 from Barry, because he at that time had a national job with the Australian Curriculum Authority and he couldn't do this as well. And I think I might have been the Stephen Bradbury of the project because I was the only one left when everybody else had withdrawn, but it certainly changed my life. But this is an example of labour being removed from an occupation. You wouldn't go to a 10-pin bowling alley and find kids down there straightening up the pins anymore. But these were the skills, and we decided in the beginning, towards the end of 2009, the beginning of 2010, that if we combined problem solving with collaboration, with critical thinking and communication, and we coined the phrase collaborative problem solving. We just invented the phrase in 2010 in London at a conference there with a small meeting, and then the people on that advisory board and the people from the corporations began to lobby organisations like the OECD to start testing schools around the globe in these particular skills, in this case in collaborative problem solving, which is a very interesting strategy because it didn't exist. It was just an idea, and we had to find a way to build the kind of assessments that were set up. At the time, the Australian curriculum was being devised, and they were looking at a different set of 21st century skills, clearly literacy, numeracy, ICT literacy, and intercultural understanding and ethical understanding become what's known as the general capabilities that are expected to be embedded within maths, science, history, geography, and the subjects being taught. But typically, in education, if it's not assessed, it's not important, and if it's not important, we don't worry about it. We do what is important, and what is important is tested. And what's tested now in NAPLAN is literacy and numeracy, and that's really up until the end of May in every school year, and every school in Australia is emphasised to death and destroys educational thinking in many ways. Normally I would say that this is typical of an education classroom probably when I was at school, 50-55 years ago. This is what a classroom certainly looked like, and I don't like the idea that these classrooms still exist, and I didn't think that was the case until my daughter came home from overseas, went to teach in a prestigious school, and this describes her classroom now. So how will we learn in 2040? Just like that. Because now the classrooms are starting to change and they're starting to look quite different. And the power of the internet, the influence of Google, of LookSmart, of Yahoo, all of those, are taking over the role of the expert teacher, the person who transmits information. Because now, if you want to know something, you just go straight to Google, you find out, type in the person's name or the idea that you want, you've got the information straight away. So kids are a long way ahead of their teachers in many ways in terms of the expertise and the knowledge of it. This has led, in 2015, to the World Economic Forum that was held in the Middle East. They then commissioned Boston Consulting to take a look at what skills might be emphasised, not in schools, but in workplaces, in schools and in learning. And they described these three sets of skills, the fundamental literacies, the competencies, and the personal attributes that would be needed as manufacturing gave way to a knowledge economy and the kinds of skills and characteristics that students were going to need, I hesitate to say what's going to be things, what's going to happen in 2040, because it's changing so fast. We can easily map out the farm to the factory to the office and then to the internet, but that's now. Where is that going to end up in? So what we've got is a situation we don't know what students need to learn. We don't know what jobs will exist. We don't know what problems they'll need to address. We can sort of predict some of them. So we have to equip students in schools, in our universities, to deal with problems that don't exist, to do jobs that don't exist, to do the kind of social interaction activities and social media that still don't exist. And so the best bet that we can do is to start thinking about these kinds of generic skills and start to try and embed those generic skills into the curriculum as a kind of insurance policy, as a kind of safety net set of skills. So each of these, the ability to read, to use maths, to science, to deal with scientific principles and scientific thinking, ICT literacy. We're at the situation where in 2017 we're expecting the first of our national testing programs in schools to be offered online for the first time. Kids will type their essay. I would imagine by 2040 that's not going to be relevant, because things like Dragon's dictation, speech recognition is going to get better. It has to be really good for me, because it put some real howlers into some of the things. I once, during this project, I had to write to the Singapore government and ask them to send me their data files. And just as I had finished pressing send, I realised that it said pedophiles. That's funny. I just want the floor to open up. And
Why, yes.
Yes. So the competencies, we need now to be thinking about problem solving, critical thinking, creativity, communication, collaboration, the four C's. Moving critical thinking, creativity, communication and collaboration, the four C's are not replacing but are now supplementing the three R's in terms of the types of skills that need to be taught. And the attributes that students that the Boston Consulting survey and study tended to suggested this. And when I was speaking with a journalist recently and going through this list of attributes, the journalist pointed out that entrepreneurial spirit was missing. The idea of risk-taking and being an entrepreneur should be surely listed in this kind of context of knowledge change in society. The Economist, in its intelligence unit, did this very large survey, also produced its report in May of last year, and talked about the same kinds of outcomes that are expected by employers as kids leave both school and or university, the kinds of skills. And they were critical of the fact that education is in a response mode and certainly not in any form of leadership mode. I don't know whether that's a fair criticism, but it's certainly a persistent thing that comes along. The New York Academy of Sciences, which is an extraordinarily prestigious organisation, is currently examining the kinds of STEM, the science, technology, engineering, mathematics curriculum, from a global perspective, and they're putting together the kinds of literacy skills that they want, but also the kinds of pedagogy and infrastructure that schools need, and then they'll begin to build ways of evaluating school curricula to see to what extent this sort of curriculum is being implemented. And again, we can see the critical thinking, the communication, creativity, collaboration still moving in there. ICT literacy, now called data literacy or digital literacy. The kind of attributes, the STEM mindset, but still entrepreneurial and risk-taking is not there. And when I think about one of our Melbourne schools at the moment at Templestowe Secondary College, entrepreneurship is the key glue that pulls everything in that school together. The kids are taught to be entrepreneurs. When they leave school, they already know how to earn a living. They already have those sorts of skills. They're already earning a living in the school, and every student in the school is earning paid, has paid employment. It's an extraordinary school if you get a chance to go and take a look at it. The kinds of instructional design strategies that are needed in the school are also being outlined by the New York Academy, and they expect to release their report possibly about September, October of this year. It is surprising to me, but I'm on the working party dealing with the collaboration, and largely because of the work that I've been doing with them. So there's a large number of people. There's about eight of us working on the collaboration working party, and we multiply that by the number of lists on those lists. It's a massive organisation. I expect to draw heavily on that when I start with the UNESCO. So the idea that they'll be looking at how to assess a school curriculum and its preparation of students for a knowledge economy, and in particular the emphasis on STEM skills, will have, I think, a fairly resounding impact, as much as the PISA project is expected. And that given that these two things are going to coincide, it may be the kind of seismic shock that the school systems need, or that ministers of education need. Ministers of Education will probably get the shock in January, February 2017 when the PISA results are released, and we find that Australia's 32 out of 33 in the OECD nations. The minister's likely to say, oops, what are we going to do about that? The worst thing that could happen is we could come first on that particular rank, because our ministers would sit back and say, wow, aren't we good? But that's unlikely. I've been invited repeatedly to Taiwan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, and all they want to know is, how do we develop these skills in the kids? What are the teaching strategies that we need to get into the schools to develop those things? So we've got these chopstick economy countries which are really looking towards the future and trying to develop their curriculum around these sorts of skills. We're asleep at the wheel here in Australia. The whole idea of a teacher is changing as well. As we move from an industrial type economy and a curriculum based on that, we move from the teacher being an expert who does what I'm doing now, stands or sits and delivers, and people soak it up, hopefully, if you're still awake. We want to move from there to be a kind of interactive scale, and probably the most famous of these is a Russian psychologist called Lev Vygotsky, who invented a phrase called the zone of proximal development, where we could find where a student had reached on a particular trajectory, and if we taught at that level, we were likely to get success. If we taught above that level, it would be just frustrating. If we taught below that level, it would be boring. But maximum impact at about that point. And he invented the notion called scaffolding, where teachers are taught in their teacher education or in their professional development to build around what they can do to help them build at about that level the things they're struggling with. And in fact, it requires the teacher to recognise where the kids are struggling, not what they can do, not where they're comfortable, but where their performance is inconsistent. Sometimes they can do it, sometimes they can't. That becomes the kind of zone of proximal development. And one of the things that we've previously done and published in this book are really empirical ways of identifying that zone and targeting the instruction. But even that requires that the teachers have the competencies that they're trying to develop in the students in order to scaffold them. And increasingly, Our situation is that the kids are leaping ahead of the teacher in most of the knowledge-based subjects, because they can find out from the internet, and they get it in the Khan Academy for mathematics. Anything you want to know about history, geography, you can find even how to write essays, and you can look up all of that sort of thing and get these strategies on the internet. So the teacher, who is the expert and says, this is the way we do, this is what you want to know, is becoming redundant. And the kids are ready to learn things that the teachers have not yet acquired. So as we move into that kind of economy and that kind of society, the knowledge base of the teachers is dropping behind the knowledge base of the student, and so even the social constructivist model of scaffolding and learning and propping up those kids is disappearing. Last November I was in Moscow at the institute where Vygotsky actually taught and researched, and I did a seminar like this, and I got to this point where I was saying that Vygotsky's theory collapses in a knowledge economy when kids can progress much faster than the teacher. The dean at the time was sitting next to me and said, "No, there's always somebody who can help." I decided not to pursue the point, but I don't resile from it. I think that Vygotsky's is a brilliant model, and a lot of our work has been focused on developing our pre-service teacher course on that model. But increasingly we've got to move now to both teacher and student. And interestingly, some of the research we're currently doing with teacher teams or collaborative teams of teachers working with flexible groups of students in the classroom, students grouped according to where they are on this trajectory and intervening at that, we make the assumption that if we put teachers together in a team, they know what to do. More, if we make the assumption if we put the kids in a team or a group working on a similar type level of difficulty, they know what to do. And both assumptions are wrong. Teachers don't know what to do, and the kids don't know what to do. It's just an accident if something happens that's positive. Luckily, the accidents are fairly prevalent, and if we can get into those groups of kids who do progress, and we can get into the groups of teachers who do have success, it's not just showing the teachers how to become self-regulated in terms of their development, and it's not just about getting the kids to be self-regulated, it's how do we get the teachers to transfer that skill so that the kids become more advanced. And we find that with our schools, teachers are increasingly focusing on the bottom end of the spectrum, the kids at risk of not learning. And the kids at the top of our spectrum are not learning, not progressing. We have samples in excess of 35,000 kids from Victorian schools, which illustrate the bottom 25%, steep increase in performance. The top 25%, absolutely flatlining. The teachers are focusing on the bottom quarter for a number of reasons. One, those kids are at risk of not learning. We hope that never changes. Two, teachers begin to realise, "I don't know how to teach the kids at the top." And three, not only do I not know how, I don't know the topic. I don't know the substance. And our teachers are becoming increasingly willing to admit that I don't know how, or I don't know. So there's a gap that's got to be fit. And we can either teach them to be better mathematicians, better readers, better geographers, better scientists, or we can teach them ways of learning. And we can teach the kids ways of learning as a much more efficient model. And that's really where we've gone in our work. And so to come back to the 1940 issue, I think by the time we get there, hopefully, our schools, our teachers, our students are all autonomous learners. And they're able to do that. And to use a whole range of sort of things that will enable them to become better learners. Both UNESCO and OECD have been running workshops this year on the idea of 2030, education 2030, not 2040. But 2030 is an interesting number, because if we think about the five-year-olds who start school in 2017, those who turn up in January next year to prep or foundation year, 2030 is when they graduate at year 12. Suddenly, 2030 is not very far away. It's these kids. 2034, some of them will become teachers. Some of them will become lawyers, accountants. Will they be the same kind of teacher that they are taught with by now? Will year 12 feel the same? God help it, I hope it's not. That's really the momentum, the inertia that's built up in education, that if we think about that five-year-old group of kids, by the time they get to year 12, if they're still doing the same curriculum as we've got now, we ought to call a referendum on that. Or a
plebiscite.
Or a plebiscite, yes. So what the OECD has found is that schools are struggling to keep up with the rate of change, and that by the time these kids have moved through, the professions that they might enter will be different. What are we going to do with the kids from the bowling alley who might be doing routine manual tasks? What are we going to do with the kids who we currently prepare to work in agriculture, in mining, in cleaning, in manual tasks that are at this stage not digitized, but we can almost bet that at some stage in the future, digitising of many of those occupations will take place and they will disappear? How do we create a society that enables those kids to participate and not become totally disenfranchised because we don't have an education system that can turn them into a contributing adult in society? These are the kids who are 4 years old now. In January next year, they'll start school. And we really need to think about what are we going to do with those kids? Because I think one of the statistics about litigation in the United States, 80% of personal litigation in the United States is unrepresented. Mr. Google is the lawyer. And if the law profession is going to be changed so dramatically, what can we think about in terms of teaching and the kinds of roles and knowledge and skills that teachers are going to need if Mr. Google is going to replace them as the expert? So we'd expect that we've got all kinds of things. We need competencies for all economies. We can selfishly think about what are we going to do in Australia, but we also need to think about, as I've talked about Africa before, we're going to some of those countries in Africa, it's another era, it's going back 100 years in many cases. The digital divide may become a quite serious issue. In the Middle East, while we've got some problems there at the moment, in Egypt, 56% of university graduates are unemployed. 56% of university graduates unemployed. Why? Because the university curriculum is simply geared towards dig it up and sell it. In Tunisia, the same thing applies. In Jordan, the government controls the school curriculum and half the population of Jordan is under the age of 18 years old. They're all in a school system which is refusing to adjust to a kind of economy and a knowledge society and a global type of society. So if we think there's a problem in the Middle East at the moment, there's a brewing time bomb sitting underneath where we've got university well-educated, irrelevant adults unable to gain employment in any systematic way. So the British Council has started to take a look at the work that we've been doing on collaborative work and collaboration, social and cognitive skills, to start thinking about strategies that might be used in the Middle East to change education there. There has to be implications for teacher education. My goodness, if we think education is difficult to change, try changing teacher education, because we're all experts and we're very fond of our expertise. So if we just think about the sort of things for the future, where will we live? What sort of context will that be? What's the environment? Where will we work? How long will we live? How will we die? These are all issues that, what will we own? How will we learn? That's one of the questions for tonight, but it's in a mass of other questions that we really need to think about, and the kind of changes. So what I was saying before, that education needs to prepare kids for occupations that don't exist, to solve problems we don't know about, to learn things that don't yet even appear. How can we do that if we have a content-based curriculum and a quantity of learning, and how much we reward people for how much they know? How can we do that if we don't know what the curriculum or what the society is going to be? So we need to be taking up that kind of insurance to prepare kids for it by giving them skills that enable them to make the transition from what could be an agrarian society into an industrial, into an information age, and move from the farm to the factory to the office, and then to the internet. Makes you wonder what will happen to buildings like this, doesn't it, if we move into an internet age where they don't need to go to work. So we started then to think about how would we solve some of this, and because clearly it needs a massive collaborative effort around the globe to even begin to address it. And we've started with this very tiny little thing called collaborative problem solving, looking at human-to-human interaction. And because it was funded by the digital companies, we did it on the internet. We worked out how to have kids interact with one another over the internet, solving problems and working through. But the other thing we did was not to have a test question with a multiple choice and tick this box. We just let them play games, problem-solving games. And then we tracked at the back, if you think behind the screen, the computer was accumulating all of this information about them, about where they clicked. We then mapped out everything was on the screen. Every piece of information they would need, we'd know what the coordinates on the screen, where it was. We'd know every piece of information on the screen, whether it was relevant or not relevant to solving the problem. We knew what the students had to do to solve the problem by clicking, dragging and dropping. So there were productive moves, there were unproductive moves. We allowed them to chat to one another so that they could talk, not speak, but to write to one another so we could capture it. And we captured every piece of chat, every action, everything they did, almost every thought they had. And we could classify all of that as productive, unproductive, relevant, not relevant. And we could begin to unravel the way in which they interacted in problem solving, and they were playing a game. And from that game, we were able to develop their social participation skills, their cognitive problem solving skills, the way in which they participated, the extent to which they can see a problem from the perspective of another person, the way in which they can organise themselves to jointly tackle the problem, the way in which they could analyse the problem and see what was relevant, what was not, and the way in which they could build knowledge. So we had five strands of information that we could capture, and we'd programmed it in such a way that when the students were finished with the exercise, the teacher could log on and download reports on the students immediately. And despite the fact that I was saying Vygotsky wasn't there, we were able to identify the zone of proximal development on each of those five levels for teachers to intervene and improve their performance. So all of that meant that it was interactive via the internet, global type of work, and collaborative problem solving became, these were the 10 skills identified at the end of 2009, critical thinking, problem solving, communication, collaboration, all became defined as collaborative problem solving. Last year, the United States dedicated $35 million to the development of new tasks in collaborative problem solving for their national assessment program in 2017. I'm hoping that reverberates around the world and gives the other countries something to think about. We can think about it in terms of problem solving, collaboration and critical thinking, combining to become collaborative problem solving, having social skills and cognitive skills. The social skills, their ability to participate. I've got this wonderful word called lurkers, who came sit and watch everybody else do the task. But the design of the task is such that the problem cannot be solved unless everybody participates, and no one person can solve the problem on their own. I'll give you an example. If we have three or four students sitting around a table in the classroom, and we give them a jigsaw puzzle, and we put all the puzzle pieces on the table, and we say to the students, solve the problem, there'll be one dominant who will do most of the work, and then when it's all done, everybody gets a B or a C or an A for the grade on that. But if we give you some pieces, me some pieces, you some pieces, and you some pieces, and we say, solve the problem, it cannot be solved by anybody on their own. And no one can solve it on their own. and it cannot be solved unless everybody contributes the resources they control to the task. That's collaboration, and that's not teamwork, that's not group work, that's collaborative work. The thing that sets it apart is the interdependence of people and the fact that they each control resources, and it cannot be solved unless everybody contributes. So that's participation. They need to be able to see the problem from another person's perspective, and they need to work out how we're going to do this together, the kind of social regulation. We also need them to be able to explore, because we set it up so that they couldn't see each other's screen on the computer either. So they had to communicate to find out what have you got, what have I got, and what's relevant and what's not relevant. And all of that communication and analysis had to take place in advance. And then we could start on solving the problem, moving through to try and set up the kind of participation or hypothesis testing. So these became the kind of general levels of... There can't be any lurkers if you've got pieces of the jigsaw puzzle you've got to contribute. Or another simple example would be a crossword puzzle. You give some students the across clues and other students the down clues. They can't do it on their own. They must collaborate. So that became the way in which we set out for perspective taking. Could they integrate the contribution of their partners? Are they even aware of their partners and the sorts of things that they were doing? Some very technical stuff. Meta memory just means how good am I at this, and will I adjust my performance? Transactive memory, to evaluate their partner's contribution and adjust their own performance. Negotiation skills. Interestingly, we've had universities wanting to play some of these games with their undergraduate students to develop a measure of their capacity to negotiate. And leadership, or taking responsibility. We can also take the idea of the task regulation and analysing the problem, setting goals, managing resources, and being able to deal with ambiguity or unclear problems. And then problem solving, collecting information, being systematic, formulating relationships, that is, if-then, rules and relationships, forming generalisations, and then getting kids to test hypotheses. And that sounds very technical, but in fact, if we can get kids in any grade level, any year level, to start talking about what if, what about, or it depends, and using those three expressions, challenge a generalisation. And that's all an hypothesis is. It's testing whether a generalisation stands up under all kinds of conditions. So that's really where we're getting to, trying to get teachers to develop this method of solving problems. So we need to know what we're measuring, how is it measured, coding, of developing ways of recording the observation of theirs. And this is where I want to go in now and show you some of these tasks. This is some of the tasks. The hot chocolate is really just looking at someone controls the resources, the ingredients, another one controls the menu information, so they've got to work together to solve that. How much plant, how much food to give a plant, what sort of conditions and soil. The beam balance, we'll have a look at that in a moment. One controls the balance, the other one controls the weights. The clowns is the fairground clowns. You put the ping pong balls in the clown's mouth and you've got to share 12 balls to see whether or not they operate the same way. This is a plant growth to see how far it goes. It could also be a rocket ship and the type of fuel. Small pyramids is a maths task based on Fibonacci series. Game of 20 is a critical value task, and olive oil is a very famous problem of the 5-litre and the 3-litre task. But the beam balance is one which works out that's quite a collaborative task. If we treat this as a seesaw, Lynn and I were touring in New Zealand a couple of years ago, and we walked past this in the park. So I took a photograph of it, because this is clearly a collaborative task. One person could not do this on her own. Could not, without being in a real comedy routine anyway. Put the bricks on one end and run up the other end to get it off. So they had to work out, what was the nature of the problem, where to place the weights to to get it to be perfectly balanced. In the classroom, we use this on the screen. So that player A, student A, can see where the weights are. Student B can has to give instructions of where to put the weights to make it balanced. They must communicate to make it work. Let's see if I can make it work there.
I think that gets it. Okay, I'm B now.
Oh, yeah. It's harder on this. Okay, so balance, I share a set of skills with my partner.
You can see the screen is information they need to acquire.
Try and make it balanced.
They can only talk to one another through this chat box.
Too hard.
And they can control where the weights are on the balance.
Different masses, but only one at a time. Drag them to the transfer pad. Oh, that disappeared. Oh, so I can't see my partner's side of the scales. And my partner says, I've got nothing but scales, so they've not got any masses to begin with.
No. I'm going to put these 50 grams on, let's just try place 4 and we'll see what happens. I just have to wait for my partner, I suppose, to give me other weights because I don't have anything to do on the screen.
I'm actually searching
almost balances, but not
for the
quite.
Thing here so I can move it along.
Only got the 15,
that's another
so
thing I haven't got.
Oh, okay. I need to send that back.
I'm not quite sure what I can do because I've only got one.
That gives an idea of the task. I won't play them all because in order to see them all, you have to do the MOOC.
And you'll give us a link to the MOOC at some stage?
Indeed, we will.
Good.
We've delivered the MOOC twice and we're revising it for a third go this year. So that's the balance. And we saw the photograph in the park. This is one of my staff at the university, her daughter. Her daughter is this one. They're trying to balance this now. It does need sound, and that's a bit of a shame because I don't think we've got any. But we can. What we're looking for here is the kinds of skills that the students are showing. And it's not even going to play. Oh, it won't play. That's right, because QuickTime doesn't exist on this. So what happens is that this student here, they squeal and shout at one another about what they're not doing, because what they've got to do is pull down the seat and jump up on the seat in order to balance the beam. Eventually this one runs over and says, let's try something together. I'll count to 3 and then we both jump together. It's another example. This could not be solved by one student. It only can be solved if they both collaborate on this one. So the beam balance we could see on the seesaw, we could see it in the science classroom, we can see it in the playground. It's another kind of math science task of the response of plants to heat and light. Shared garden, depending upon where you plant they either flourish or die, so they've got to work out how to do it together. The clown's task is the simplest of them all, but occasionally we get and people who want to do everything on their own, they use all 12 balls and the partner has nothing.
Okay, so me and my partner both have a laughing clown machine. We can drop balls into the clown's mouth to see how the machine works. We need to find out if the machine works exactly the same as my partner's. We have 12 balls to share. I can see I have a laughing clown machine with 3 different options. And I have these balls, which I can move.
Okay, so it says me and my partner both have a climb machine. I wonder if theirs is the same as mine, though. I've got three tubes, left, middle, and right. Okay. Oh, there's a ball just disappeared, so... Oh, yeah, we have 12 balls to share. Okay, so I can use any of these. Let's try. Put it in the left, and it comes out position one.
I'll stop that, because the notion is that they need to negotiate about how to perform this, how to do the task. Normally I have a runner along the bottom where I can drag it through, but I can't at the moment. Don't know why that's not doing it at all. What we're adjusting this so that it's not always the same. It's randomly same, randomly different. And we're building another layer on it to see if they can maximise a score by working together. This is another task.
But it wouldn't have us here. We'd get some 14-year-olds.
I really need my slide to be, because this is a lot of... This is our staff doing this. One of them gets a bit cussing at the moment, so I need to slide past that.
I don't know what's next. I know we have to do game of 20, but I don't know what else. What's the other one? Balance. I hate balance.
Actually,
let's do game 20. We'll make clear. Oh, wait a minute, she can't do balance by herself.
Okay, it's not too long, though.
We have to do it.
Is that on the right
side? Oh, look, I'm not going to play it through because I can't control the speed and it just takes so long. What it is that they compete together against the computer. And there are critical values that they need to work out, that they've got to get the tally, otherwise the computer will beat them every time. And they need to take it in turns, to take the tokens and put the tokens onto the screen. In every task, there is what we call an aha moment, where suddenly they realise that there's something specific that they must do in order to solve the problem. Before they get to that point, a lot of their activity is exploratory, trial and error, random. But once one of them realises that there's three critical numbers that they need to get in this task, or they realise that they must negotiate the tokens for the clown, once they get to that point, they become strategic, and you can see the change in the behaviour pattern of the students once they become strategic. With this task, the idea is to get to use the 3-litre task. Use the 3-litre task, not to fill it, but to get 4 litres in there. It's a very old problem, but it's an idea.
Kids would usually call the other person, the partner, their partner.
I suppose it's referred to throughout as partner, so we have to do something consistent.
It does say partner, doesn't it?
It's like partner, wait in. Partner.
Don't chat as much, the chat box.
I'm not going to play it because they go on forever. I really need that slide where I can cut out their gas baggie. It can be solved in 4 steps. But I've heard 2 PhD students, not PhD students, PhD graduates at the university, reduced to shouting at one another over this task. And I went to Sydney, in a very large educational organisation in the centre of Sydney. I had 2 very senior staff members, professionals, looking at this task. What happens is one controls the 3-litre, the other controls the 5-litre, and the transfer. One controls the provider, the supply of oil, and the other one controls the 5-litre and the transfer. Both of these people were sitting about as far away a distance as Lynn and myself, and they're both exasperated because they knew the problem. They couldn't solve it because they didn't have all the information. It didn't occur to these very senior professionals to ask their colleague what they had. So their perspective-taking skills were near to zero. Their collaboration skills were almost zero. They were because they were expert, they expected to solve the problem. And this is an issue that we're confronted with in teachers a lot. Teachers are expect to be able to do it. And when they can't do it, something wrong with the task. This is another one. It's just cameras and corridors in a warehouse and using cameras to arrange the cameras in such a way that they can see, they cover all corridors of a warehouse. And that gets increasingly difficult and more complicated with more rows and columns. And there's a relationship, an algebraic relationship between the number of cameras and the number of columns and rows. And they have to work out the mathematics of it. You can see it getting increasingly complex as we go. There's another one. They build a formula with adding numbers to form equations and numbers. This is a very difficult task and one that we don't... So this becomes the recipe, the menu rather, of all the tasks in terms of the amount of time that it takes. What we're doing all the time when they're working through those is capturing all of those tasks, they're capturing the ideas and information that they're playing with and building a log file. So prior to starting, we map everything that's on the screen. We then watch what we're doing. They become familiar with the problem. They inquire and explore. They collect data. Down the bottom here, there will be negotiation, strategic thinking, and then resolution, and finally evaluation. The very best problem solvers don't accept that there's only one solution. They stop and they start to say, could we do that more efficiently? Could we do it better? And they're the very, very best problem solvers. So that all becomes a data file, which I'll show you in a moment. It looks like this when we captured all the data. But there's columns... The columns tell us a lot about them. The student ID, there's two students, so we've got two, these are Australian students. This is the task, and it's actually the clown's task, and there's student A and student B. And we can see here the coordinates from the screen and where they picked up something on the screen and took it to another coordinate, which tells us they picked it up from the tray and dropped it into the column 1, column 2 or column 3. So mapping out what's happening on the task and then the chat of what they say, we're able to do a lot of inferences about what the students were thinking, their social and cognitive skills when they're working that through. For example, the number of times they chat to one another before and during actions gives us a lot of information about what is being said. We've given the data to people in the United States now to begin to analyse what the text actually says. Because the kids write in SMS language. It's all this short term. Now, they don't write in complete sentences. They don't even talk to one another in complete sentences. They talk to one another in SMS language. And this is an entirely new field of linguistics research now. And we're able to supply the linguists with a lot of this. But this is really just a frequency count. That if they don't do much chatting, they're not communicating. If they do lots of chatting, they are communicated. So we say, that's a zero, that's a one. This one is how much time elapses before the first action takes place. And we got from here, from 0 to 3 seconds before they do anything. Well, they do that before 3 seconds has elapsed. Our inference is they didn't read the instructions. Then between 3 seconds and about 20 seconds, they've taken some effort to find out about it. And beyond that, we don't know what they did, but they certainly weren't attending to the task all the time. What we're hoping to do now is to take eye tracker so that we might be able to work out what these students are doing with tracking eye movements. They're not looking at the screen anymore. They must have gone for lunch or something. So then we code that with a 0, a 1 and a 2 in terms of the impact of communication. And what that does is we end up with a normal statistical data file like this. We convert it all to numbers as codes. or each code means something to us, but that enables us now to think about how do we interpret it. And if this was a test, a multiple choice test, and we had a column like this with ones and zeros, where one represented the correct answer and zero represented the incorrect answer, we'd make an assumption that that test question, that item, was really easy, because look at all the ones compared to the zeros. And using that logic, that frequency of occurrence was a pseudo measure of difficulty, we could take much of the old psychometric theories and superimpose that on it, so that we could develop and calibrate the tasks in terms of their relative difficulty, and at the same time get an estimate of the student's ability using psychometric theory. And we reviewed all of these indicators many times. We first of all broke it in, we got one measure, then we broke it into social and cognitive skills, and then into five strands. The five strands were participation, perspective, social, task, and knowledge building. And we could provide a profile of the student to every student, to the teacher, in terms of those skills and where they went. What happens is our statistical analysis. These are the columns in the data file. These are the students. It's interesting how this normal distribution turns up everywhere. But this would be simple presence of chat. This one up here is still the clown's task, and this is a student who, or the action that they test every possible combination. That's very rare that someone would do that. Most people would get to about here, say, oh yes, that's always 1, 3, 4, or 1, 2, 3, 2 in that order. But these students up the top are very persistent, checking and rechecking, and they'll change every combination. So student at the top is very capable, unusual. Students at the bottom just do the minimum. The ones at the top, the tasks of the items at the top are the most difficult, and the ones at the bottom are the most easy to do. And that enables us then, not just clowns, to put lots of tasks together and use the coding system that we've recorded to get a student measure. And we can see here we've got behaviour number 33 in three different levels of performance. And then we take a look at our Australian students in terms of participation, perspective taking, social regulation, task analysis, and problem solving. The higher this distribution, the more able. And we can see our Australian students, and we didn't compare all the countries, but our Australian students are very good on the social aspects, not so good on the cognitive, on the problem solving. So from a curriculum perspective, we really need to boost their problem solving skills, and without robbing their enjoyment of it. The most common complaint we get from students when we're testing them is, we ran out of time. We want to keep going. That's an unusual test. So we're able then to describe their cognitive behaviour. We're able to provide description of the students' social and cognitive skills of increasing sophistication. We're able to provide the teacher with every one of those levels and the kinds of zone of proximal development. We report them in this way. We don't give a score. The black line represents where the student is at. That's just the point of intervention for the teacher in whatever strand that is. The class report tells where every student in the class is at, and we get a social and cognitive profile of the student. This little squiggle at the top here is a date. So with pre and post, we now tell what they've learned, how much they've learned, and how fast they're learning, how fast those skills are developing. I would hope by 2040 we're successful in getting that kind of reporting system in the schools. So, finally, there's the context. We're 6 countries, and we're measuring the same thing in all the 6 countries. We could take each of the indicators, the difficulty level, in Australia, Finland, United States. This is mapping Australia against 4 of those countries. And statistically, we could say if they were identical, everything would be along this middle line. And from your introductory stats program, this is a confidence interval, for error. we're able to put our hand on our heart and say we're measuring the same thing in all of those countries. Mm-hmm. And the effect of language, curriculum, culture is washed out. And there isn't many tests in the world that can say that. So, I think that's the future in assessment, and so do a lot of other people, that we can move away from paper and pencil look-alike multiple choice tests to these kinds of interactive tests that are measuring what we call soft skills, but skills that are increasingly important in a knowledge and connected society as we move away from manufacturing and agrarian type work. And these are the sorts of skills that we're hoping that kids will need, at least up to 2030. I can't go as far as 2040. And that's where we'll stop. How